I'm down on my way to Harlem. Ellington, you don't live around here. He moved away one day, so they say, from Harlem. I can hear his echo still. Na na na, you can't keep me away from where I was born.
That's Gregory Porter with On My Way to Harlem. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Thursday, December the 20th, and members of the Senate and House Foreign Affairs Committees are insisting that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton answer questions about the attack on the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi, Libya, on September the 11th, that claimed the lives of four Americans, including Ambassador Christopher Stevens. In the wake of a scathing report by an investigative panel, four State Department officials so far have resigned. There's still no deal on the budget. Republicans say they won't accept President Obama's version, and President Obama says he will veto whatever the Republicans present as an alternative. And as funerals for the victims of the mass killings in Newtown, Connecticut continue, the National Rifle Association, which is preparing to make a formal statement about the tragedy tomorrow, reportedly is seeing a noted increase in membership since the tragedy. Not long ago, Harlem was a model of Black urban achievement and the epicenter of Black political power in the United States. Today, Harlem is but a shadow of its former self in almost every sense of the word. Harlemites openly concede that. How did this come to be? Our guest, Kermit Eady, attributes the decline of Harlem and the Harlems of the United States to plantation politics, Black elected officials and leaders willingly becoming stand-ins for political and economic interests bent on exploiting and ultimately destroying these once thriving communities. Kermit Eady, a social scientist by training, is a founder and former president of and CEO of the Black United Fund of New York, which sought to organize the human and financial resources of African American and minority people to participate in their growth, development, and empowerment by utilizing, as he called it, the operational principles of self-help, mutual aid, volunteerism, and venture philanthropy. And he joins us today. Kermit, nice to have you with us. I'm not hearing. So let's take this break and find out. Oh, there you are. Yes, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, very much so. Can hear you now.
Okay. Yes.
Good.
Thank you very much for having me today.
I'm delighted to have you join us. Well, let's start with where things are. What is the state of affairs with the Black United Fund?
Well, the state of affairs with the Black United Fund, it's pitiful. It's really, really pitiful. As you know, years ago, the founder of the National Black United Fund, Walter Bremond, came to Virginia, where I was working at Norfolk State as the Director of Admissions and Recruitment at the Graduate School of Social Work there. And he and Dr. King Davis convinced me to come back to New York and start a fund in New York. They had a few funds around the country, but most of them were in, you know, just a state of not doing very much. The biggest ones was Los Angeles and at that time Detroit. And so I accepted the challenge to come back to New York. They didn't have much money, but I says, you know, the mission of the fund made it interesting to me, because this is something that my dad had always said, and he always said, Kermit, he told all of his boys, not just me, if you take care of the land will take care of you. Of course, we didn't give a nickel about that at that time, but we later learned to respect and understand what the heck he was talking about. So I accepted that challenge, and I came back to New York and started a Black United Fund in 1979, and we did it until, they threw me out August 2003.
So, well, that was the beginning. Follow on that phrase. They threw you out. Who are the they, and why did they throw you out?
Well, the person that took it was Elliot Spitzer, who was then Attorney General. He threw out my board of directors, and he brought in five African Americans from Nassau and Suffolk County. In fact, Lance Clark, who was one of them, always bragged that he never spent a night in Harlem in his life. I said, well, what are you doing here? He says, well, I've been appointed by Spitzer, Mr. Spitzer. Lance Clark is an attorney, and he lived in Nassau County. And, you know, they came in, and they were there for about 3-4 months. And one day when I was visiting my sister upstate New York, I got on Friday, I'll never forget that, I got a phone call, and the phone call said, Kermit, you're never allowed in the office again. You cannot go back. I says, what? They said, you cannot go back. And I says, well, what are you doing with my awards and plaques and my clothing? Because of the founder, I had all kinds of things in the office that were personal. And they immediately said, well, we'll send it to you. Well, I said, but I need to pick up my stuff. They said, we'll send it to you. They never spoke to me again. And then they assigned two black men on Lenox Avenue around 121st Street to take all the stuff out, and they threw it all in the dumpster. They threw all of my stuff in the dumpster, and they threw out my board of directors, and they put in Spitzer's board, because as you may know, not-for-profits in New York State, in most states, of course, New York State, come under the auspices of the Attorney General. And they can walk in any time and tell you that, you know, they're taking over and you're not allowed back in the building again. So that's exactly what they did. I was never allowed back. And then we went through deposition, me and my staff. And when they couldn't find anything wrong, believe me, they told the politicians, don't open their mouth. Now, I was known by all the politicians in Harlem. See, Virginia Fields, Charles Rangel, Keith Wright, who else? Well, even Hazel Dukes, they all knew me in Harlem. David Patterson. But they wouldn't even talk to me anymore. So they took it over. And when they couldn't find anything, you know, the donors said, well, we're not going to give any more if Kirby Dede is not here because we don't know these people. And they, well, you know, the attorney general told us. And they says, well, we don't care who the attorney general is. We're not going to give any more. And the donors stopped giving. And, of course, Elliot Spitzer's board killed it. And they have never spoken to me since I was deposed until today's date, and that was August 2003. So you can imagine, you know, I never heard a word from Elliot Spitzer or his people after that.
Well, we certainly heard about Elliot Spitzer since that time. He was, in fact, compelled to resign in disgrace owing to his involvement in a prostitution ring, among other things. But let's talk a bit about what the Black United Fund had sought to do and was doing, and in many ways quite successfully. What was the Black United Fund doing?
Well, the Black United Fund, as you so eloquently point out, its mission to organize the human and financial resources of African American people to participate in their growth, development, and empowerment. We gave grants. We gut rehabbed 409 apartment units in Harlem, in Brooklyn, and in Queens. And, I mean, we had some rents for three bedrooms as low as $600 and change. Brand new apartments. We also had fiber optics to the wall on 137th Street between Adam Clayton Powell and Malcolm X Boulevard. And we were beginning to do school. The children were beginning to be able to go into computers and do homework from their home. We were going to push home-based businesses, and we also had two tech centers, like Kinko's, one on Adam Clayton Powell on 133rd, and the other downtown Brooklyn. And ooh, they really didn't like that. And these were just like Kinko centers. And we also bought the first African American not-for-profit radio station in the state of New York. And the Sunday before we were to go on the air, you know, that's when they threw us out and nothing happened. That they killed it. And most of our dollars, we did payroll deduction fundraising because, as you may know, up until that time, United Way was the only one involved in the payroll deduction market. Now, payroll deduction, for those who may not know, is when you let a dollar, two, three, four, five, whatever, voluntarily come out of your paycheck. Well, you know, we'd always heard that African Americans wouldn't give and all of this stuff. And, of course, the African American community was giving. They were giving. 95% of our dollars came from the African American community. And we were using those dollars to do economic development projects because one of the things I've always been convinced of, as I said earlier, without economic development, we're not going anywhere. I don't care what program we pushed in this country. We have got to have an economic base. And without that, we're not going to move. So we built economic development projects. I'll never forget, we went down to Hilton Head, South Carolina, and we saved land in the Sea Islands of South Carolina. We saved over $450,000 worth of land, and we only had $6,000. You could, in those days, you could bid on land down there for $60 for 300 and 400 acres of land. And you waited a year during the interim period, and the next year you claim your land, and whites were there with suitcases full of money. Now, we could not bid them, so we went there at the end of the interim period, and we paid, or we got a lawyer in South Carolina, and, you know, that everyone knew in Beaufort, South Carolina, and we we were saving land, and they made contracts. They were paying us $5 a month, $10 a month. And if someone passed it, couldn't pay it at all, the land was turned over to the fund. Okay, that's all we wanted to do was save the land. We weren't there to take anyone's land. Well, you know, I'll never forget when Mr. Spitzer's attorneys asked me, they said, well, no one knew what you were doing with the money, and you didn't do this, and you didn't, they didn't know you were doing economic projects. And I reached in my briefcase, and I pulled out an Amsterdam News article that we had set out surveys to all of our donors, and we got a response of 87%. We asked, it's okay, we wanted to do economic development, and 87% said, do economic development projects with our dollars. And that's what we were doing. Okay? Because as you know, there are no laws against doing economic development projects, but as a not-for-profit, there are no laws at all. Well, then Mr. Spitzer and his people didn't like it. And, of course, Mr. Rangel didn't like it either. You know, I'll never forget, I was once called in the Bill Tatum's office before he left the Amsterdam, and he wanted to know, how, before he passed, and he wanted to know how the hell was I doing Black United Fund in Harlem, and no one, I didn't get permission from the Harlem Four. And I said, what do I need permission to do something in the Black community? Well, he told me, don't ever forget, Kermit, they hate your guts. They don't like you. And we went on from there. But, you know, when he couldn't do anything about it, I strongly suspect that Charles Rangel then told Elliot Spitzer, became Attorney General, to go get me.
Because Charles Rangel, that you referred to, of course, is the senior congressman from the legendary district that was represented by Adam Clayton Powell, Jr.
That is absolutely correct. And, you know, so Spitzer started in on me, and they suspected that, you know, thievery, they could get me on thievery, because since they were all thieves, they suspected they could get me on thievery as well. And, of course, they couldn't do that. When they found that I hadn't stolen anything, they never said another word to me, never spoke to me again. And then, of course, as you know, the area where the Black United Fund is now a bar and a restaurant. First they had a bar, then they tore up the office and they put a restaurant in it. They threw out all of my clothing, and I had hundreds of plaques on the wall, and all of that got thrown in the garbage. And, hey... And, of course, a number of people said to me, well, Kermit, why don't you sue them? Well, that was a possibility, but I didn't have any money. I didn't have a dime. I didn't have a dime. And no Black lawyer that I spoke to, none that I spoke to in New York, would even think about taking the case because they were all afraid of Spitzer. Because at that time, as you may know, Spitzer was attacking the Wall Street and everybody. He was the big man. And they were all frightened. And any lawyer that wanted it, white lawyer, said, hey, you got $10,000 to give me up front. We'll do something. Well, you know, I didn't have a dime. So, you know, and then, of course, they did what they call blackball me, and I couldn't get a job anywhere around and all of that kind of stuff. But they did a number. They did a number. And the Black politicians, I mean, you know, they didn't say a word to help me. The only one that did anything at all was Charles Barron.
Charles Barron is a city councilman from Brooklyn.
Charles Barron, the city councilman. He's the only one that would do anything. David Patterson, after it was all destroyed, it was interesting. He sent word by Professor James Smalls, asked James to call me and told me he wanted to meet with me.
I just have to keep people in the loop. David Patterson is a former governor who replaced Spitzer.
Absolutely. David Patterson is the former governor of New York. He replaced Elliot Spitzer. And David wanted to meet with me, so I said, why do you want to meet with me now? It's all destroyed. So, you know, James said, you know, well, Kermit, I'm just a messenger. I can't answer any questions. So I said, well, you tell him I'll meet under the condition that I can bring with me to the meeting whomever I please. So David agreed to that. And I took with me to the meeting, of course, Professor Smalls, Michael Harding, Al Sharpton's attorney, Dr. James McIntosh, Larry Barton, and myself. And I sat very close to Mr. Patterson, and I said, all right, you call the meeting, David. Well, what is it you want to talk about? So he hung his head down for about 10 seconds, and then he lifted his head up. He says, well, Kermit, we now know that you didn't do anything wrong. I said, but the organization is destroyed. Well, why didn't you return my calls? I called you at least 20 or 30 times. He hung his head down again, and then he lifted up. He says, well, I don't believe I got any of your messages, Kermit. I said, oh, David, please. He always got my messages. I said, besides, if you didn't, why didn't you call me to ask me what was going on? Because everyone in Harlem knew, you know, I was under attack. Why didn't you call me? He hung his head again and came up. He said, well, I've got a plan. So I said, well, what's your plan? All the other guys were sitting there. He said, I would like to have legislative hearings against Elliot Spitzer of what he did to you and the Black United Front. So I looked at the other guys, and they says, all right, what do you want to do? So he said that he wanted to, he was going to meet with Bruno, who was the state.
The Republican.
Republican, yeah, chairman of the state of New York and the Senate. And Monday, and if I called him by Wednesday, you know, he'd have it all set up. Anyway, I then asked him, I said, well, David, who is this we? Who the, you said, we now know that you didn't do anything wrong. He says, well, Kermit, he said, we had a meeting with Spitzer about another item. Now, I'd heard they were going to meet with Spitzer because they were trying to save their apartments in Lenox Terrace, because the manager was putting them out. So they met with Spitzer, and after the meet, after they finished that agenda, they brought up the Black United Fund. So I said, well, who was the we? He said, the we was Charles Rangel, myself, Hazel Dukes.
Hazel Dukes was the chairperson of the NAACP.
And she still is, of the state of New York. And David Patterson, Keith Wright is an assemblyman in New York, in Harlem. And what's this other guy's name? He's a state senator. He was. He's still there. I think he's still a state senator. Anyway, and they met, and when they raised the issue with Spitzer, Spitzer told them, I'm the governor. I'll do whatever I damn well please. I said, David, are you telling me that Charles Rangel took that? He said, hey, everybody there took it. He said he wasn't talking about it. He did what he wanted to do. I says, oh, my God. So anyway, after that, you know, we talked and we left, and I called David the next week, and David wouldn't return, never returned my call, and David has not returned a call for me until this day. And, you know, never has he spoken to me.
Well, let's talk now about the Black United Fund, in a way, and what happened to it, in a way, is both symbolic and symptomatic of how a community that had the potential, and that once, of course, was a very thriving community, Harlem was a very thriving community, from your perspective, because you were involved so deeply in the development of Harlem, what accounts for the fact that Harlem seems to have completely fallen apart?
Well, you know, my opinion is, and I think I'm correct, but it's my opinion, I believe it's because of the politicians. You see, the politicians somehow, in my opinion, they're under the impression that they're there to set laws and rules and whatnot, when they are there to protect the infrastructure of the African-American community. They're there to protect what is being built in the community, not to set laws and stuff. That will be done. They can participate in that. But that's not getting us freedom. They are there to protect black-built institutions. Well, they don't see it that way. So they're just there, you know, and therefore any time anyone comes in, because as you know, since C. Virginia Fields is no longer there, they now have a white borough president, and, that's it. And as you may also know, during the election, Obama's first election, he didn't get a vote out of Harlem. Even Bloomberg spoke about it and said, what a shame. Not a black politician said a word. I mean, this is our downfall, is the history of the black political structure, particularly since Adam Clayton Powell. Adam Clayton Powell was a great man. I wonder how, you know, they don't understand how he got so much legislation passed and all of this, and he didn't have a lot of black votes there, and now they've got loads of black votes and they don't get anything done. I don't know, and I could be wrong, but I haven't heard of any black legislator in the Congress or anything getting anything done lately. I don't know of anything that they do. I mean, what are they doing other than getting a paycheck? You know, so I see the downfall of the African-American community, not only in Harlem, but around the country, as being because of the politicians. They are there. They are the gatekeepers for the white community. That's their job, to stop African-Americans from getting to the top. That's their only job, and that's what they do, day in and day out. So I don't see any hope for us until we can get rid of those politicians and a few others that are there to do the same thing. Because while we support Mr. Obama, Mr. Obama has never said a word about the African-American community, not a word. He talks about Hispanics. He talks about women. He talks a lot about different ethnic groups or different groups of people, but he never says anything about the African-American community. He's not gone to Africa. I'm hoping he goes now, but we don't know whether he's going or not, you know. But, you know, the African-Americans, when he is finished his term, we will be in the same boat or worse off than we were when he started. So I don't see the black political structure doing anything for the African-American community.
Well, Harlem, in a way, is an exception in the sense that it had such a cluster of serious political ammunition, one would say. We had a governor, David Paterson, coming out of Harlem. You have the fourth most powerful member of Congress, Charles Rangel, coming out of Harlem. Harlem produced a state comptroller, H. Carl McCall. It produced a secretary of state, Basil Paterson, the father of David Paterson. It produced not one, but I think three borough presidents, African-Americans. It produced a city council. A city clerk, David Dinkins, who went on to be mayor of the city of New York. This is serious political ammunition. How do you explain? I mean, you said that they don't do anything, but there's got to be a process that with all of this firing power, with all of this ammunition that Harlem should have had politically, its infrastructure was completely gone, and now Harlem literally is a vestige of its old, thriving, bustling self.
I have friends that call me from Harlem, and they tell me, Kermit, you should see it now. They said, I mean, we've never owned it, but we lived there. They said, hey, we've got as many whites living here as we have blacks. And, you know, and I don't have a problem. I mean, you know, they have a right to live wherever they please, but the African-Americans are not, they're not doing anything in Harlem. They're not doing a thing. You know, and Harlem had once a lot of power. You're absolutely correct. We had a lot of power. Now we don't have anything, but those people who are left, and they are just protecting the goodwill of the African American community. Of the white community. I mean, look at the Harlem Five. I mean, look at that. You know, David Dinkins said they were a bunch of rats, and they should be punished. I mean, what a shame. And now those guys have been proven innocent.
You're referring to the young men who were said to have raped a white woman in Central Park. And, of course, it turned out that they did not. But in any event, the city will not compensate them for being wrongly convicted.
Right. Oh, my God. I mean, this is awful stuff. And I haven't heard any black politicians saying, hey, you've got to do something. You've got to do something. You know, Alton Maddox is talking about it, you, myself, a few others. But that's it. They now, no one's pushing for those guys to get restitution. No one is. Definitely no black politicians are pushing for it. You know, and they know that those guys spent years in prison, and they were just abused, and they are not pushing for them to get anything from it. You know, this is a shame. And yet we've got African Americans politicians, and they don't view their role as helping the community. They view their role as, I'm saying to pass laws. I can assume that. I don't know whether they view their role as doing that or not. But they don't do anything. I don't know anything that they do. And when I say they're not doing anything, you know, I can be corrected, but I just don't know anything that they're doing. And someone can maybe let me know what is it they're doing. Because they're not doing a thing.
How do you explain the fact that they continue to be reelected, they continue to gain seniority in the various committees that they have been assigned to, and one would imagine that also should be of benefit to the communities?
Yeah, I mean, you know... you know, from what I understand, and this may sound very trivial, but, you know, Charles Rangel, the congressman, somebody, you know, lived there, a black person, call and ask him for a parking space somewhere, and he will work to get him a parking space. We know that the Dominicans uptown in Harlem, you know, they want a green card, he will fight to get them a green card. So when it's time to vote, they've all passed the word, vote for Charles Rangel. Because they don't do anything beneficial. He will get them a parking space or maybe help them get an apartment. And that's the extent of it. He doesn't do anything else. I don't know of anything that they do. And that's why I wish someone would correct me and tell me, hey, they're doing this, 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 and this. Because I don't know anything that they do. You know, I mean, they are, you know, you see a few of them on TV, they're backing Mr. Obama, and that's good. We love him. But my God, the masses of black people are going down the tube each and every single day, every day. So I don't understand what is going on. You know, I know that when I got attacked, I know they didn't come out and help me, not one of them, except Councilman Charles Barron. And, of course, you know, I think he got a little scared because he didn't have anyone else supporting me. And, you know, because they didn't do a thing. They didn't do a single thing to support me. And that's sad. We were building an economic base, and I'm saying this very honestly, you know, as we say, you know, colloquially, we were kicking a lot of butt. We had things going on. There was no question about it. And we were using the African-American community's dollars of a dollar or two or three or four, a paycheck. And we had a system whereby if you were contributed to the Black United Fund and you qualified, you would first choice to get an apartment. We had African-Americans who said that wasn't right. That wasn't right. Good gracious, this is how white folks do things all the time. You shouldn't do it that way. Let everybody have a free... No, if you can... Because, you know, if someone, a business is contributing, you know, they get some kind of reward. That's what they do all the time. Now we understand that you're not, well, it was in the press a while back. I mean, United Way doesn't give grants anymore. They're now doing what we did. They're building economically, we understand. I says, oh, my goodness. And then Ralph Dickerson, who was the head of United Way, I mean, Ralph Dickerson, after our event, Ralph Dickerson was caught, you know, it's taken a whole of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And all they told him was, Spitzer said, well, you just pay it back. That's all. That's all he had to do. I mean, this is ridiculous stuff that we go through each and every single day of our lives. You know, you see these politicians running and they said, oh, we've got to take our country back. And most of them are no more than second generation Americans. And African Americans have been here so long, we don't even have a clue as to what part of Africa we're from. But they said, oh, you know, we want to take our country. What do you mean take your country back? They didn't even give us the 40 acres and a mule. They didn't give us anything. You know, I mean, when military folks are, when military folks come out of captivity, they put them through a debriefing process. They try to get them ready for society again. Can you imagine what the African Americans felt like in the South when they were told that they were free and they could go wherever they pleased? They didn't know east from west, north from south. They didn't know anything. They weren't allowed to read. They didn't know anywhere to go. They've never been, no one has ever tried to put the African American back together again.
And I should let people know, Kermit, that I should let them know that they can call at 1-888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. We're going to continue with your discussion. We have Sarah from Dallas, and she wants to talk about you.
Greetings to you, Ms. Utrice and Mr.
Thank
Kermit
you.
Edie.
Greetings.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. It's a pleasure to hear you, Mr. Edie. I do follow your show on Saturdays, and I've called in. I had a few heated discussions with you.
Thank you.
But, Mr. Edie, this is a very serious matter, and I do appreciate your broadcast that you had on with Ms. Utrice as well as Mr. Attorney Austin Maddox. Very informative shows. This situation that you're talking about, Mr. Edie, is we're under this impression, we as in black people, we're under the impression that we are voting to elect people and put them into office to represent us. While these black faces in high places, they are there strategically to be the shopkeeper and to maintain white supremacy. They are there to be the black face, to do the dirty work, so that the white man could throw his rocks and hide his hands. That is what has been going on, and we have not seen that we have been doing the same thing. These are all showcase blacks. This is what they are. Just like I told Ms. Utrice a couple of days ago with the Tim Scott situation in South Carolina, white people want to put blacks in certain positions as showcases so we would get this false impression that we are advancing or that we are moving along because one or two of us are able to attain position. But these positions that they have attained or they are attaining, it does not benefit us. We are in a worse position. We have all more elected officials than at any given time in our history in this country, and our situation is worse than it was in the 1930s. We have less land. We own less land for our people. We don't know how to we don't know how to survive. We can't. Some of us don't even know how to plant crops. How to kill a chicken? How to pluck a chicken? If the white people decide not to truck in food into the inner city, we would all starve because when we try to run to the suburbs in the white area to buy food, they're going to gun us down like we were sitting ducks. So we are in a very dire strait, and I keep telling people this, and they keep calling me the voice of doom and gloom, but they are refusing to see that we are in a bad shape.
Amen.
So you have a question, Sarah? Or I just wanted to make a comment.
I just wanted to let that know, Ms. Utrice, because we as black people, we don't have no code of conduct in our community, Ms. Utrice. We do not hold these people accountable. You could go to the Jewish community, the Italian community, the Irish, whatever. They, when they put people in office, especially the Latinos, you are there to do a function for them. If you don't do it, they will tell you no in certain terms what the heck they're going to do to you. We don't do that. We don't have no code of conduct. We let these people, they run all over us, do whatever the heck they want to do. People like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, they should have been taken care of a long time ago. What Jesse Jackson did with Operation Breadbasket, he should not have risen to the position that he's in right now. Al Sharpton should never be in the position where he's in, where he's at right now, because we keep going along, or we keep letting these people ride over us, and they keep dragging us down with them.
Well, thank you, sir. I think you're making the point that it's one thing to say that the elected officials aren't doing their jobs, but in fact, it is also the constituencies that are electing them are not doing their jobs either. If you continue to elect people who, in your view, are not representing your interests, but you continue electing them, then the time must come some at some point that you begin to ask, what's wrong with you? Not what's wrong with them, but what's wrong with you? And this is the cycle, Kermit. We see time and again the same people going on and on and on, being elected and being elected, but the community doesn't reflect any political power, any consistent representation of the people's interests at all. And that, I think, is the point. At what point, or what has to happen for the community to stop this self-abuse by electing people who are not representing their interests?
I mean, you're absolutely correct. When this atrocity happened in Connecticut last week, and that's a horrible situation. But, no one talks about our kids who are being killed every day. Every day. I saw Michael Eric Dyson speaking the other day on Meet the Press, and he was trying to point that out. No one talks about what's happening to the kids other than the kids that happen in America and the white kids. And it's terrible. There's no question about that, regardless of color. But they're not saying anything about what happened to the African-American kid. They don't care. And that's a terrible situation. It's terrible. But I agree with you. We've got to start putting African-Americans in that can represent us. I mean, this guy that they've got in there now that's going to be a black senator from South Carolina, oh, my goodness. It's terrible.
But he is a part of a process that has an agenda and that is taking care of its interests and its business. So on one level, you could say, oh, my God. But on another level, you have to see it the other way. When people are serious about their interests, they set about doing it in a methodical way. So, I mean, the African-American community, nobody is preventing it from coming up with an alternative. Nobody is saying that you can't have effective leadership. It is just that the community insists on having ineffective leadership.
So you're absolutely correct.
So what has to happen? It makes, I mean, we keep going around this circle. People say, well, the politicians are not doing anything. And then you ask, well, what are you doing about the politicians who aren't doing anything? And you don't get an answer. So at some point, you have to cancel out the complaints because you're not seeing a determination at ground level that they are very serious about the change they want. If African Americans are dissatisfied with the leadership that they have, they ought to begin the process, or they ought to show some movement in the direction of moving to alternative leadership. But we don't see that either.
Oh, you're absolutely correct. And one of the things that you notice, that the white politicians do, I mean, they were They will practice gerrymandering. You know, they will change your district where you have more white folks in it. You know, they are very serious about protecting themselves. And, you know, and we don't seem to give one iota about it. We don't say anything. We don't do anything. I totally agree with you.
Let me ask you this, Kermit. Mm-hmm. In our time, we have the phenomenon of coalition politics. We saw it, a very good attempt at it when Jesse Jackson was running for the first time in 1984. Uh-huh. And of course, by 1988, he had become a willing hostage of the Democratic Party. But there was an investment, not just from the African-American community, but there was an across-the-board coalition formed behind him. Let's take Harlem. Harlem's, let's say, its core leadership was foundering. Is that a reason also because the coalition, because Harlem did have a kind of coalition with Latino representatives from Spanish Harlem, and we did have a kind of a coalition effort going with the Black and Puerto Rican Legislative Caucus in at the state level, certainly. We see that there should be a coalition at the city level where now the city council has a very healthy representation of African Americans and Latinos. Has that also fallen apart, the coalition politics fallen apart?
Yeah, I don't see African Americans doing anything there either. You know, when what was the lady that was elected city councilwoman? You know, there were a few. There was Charles Barron, City Councilman Barron, and others were saying, "Hey, if the Black and Latinos stick together, we've got the majority vote." And he couldn't get it done.
But guess what?
He couldn't get it done.
I hate to tell you this, but Charles Barron, the first thing that Charles Barron did after being elected, and that was the case for all of the African Americans who were swept into the city council, the first thing they did was place themselves under the leadership of a kind of marginal white elected official. That's the first vote they took. They did not vote to affirm their authority within the city council. So whether they fall on the left of center, dead center, or right of center, the African American leadership coming into the city council on this crest of political will by the community, the first vote they took betrayed the interests of the community for enhanced political power and representation. And to that effect, they couldn't get a stop sign installed without asking permission from their own leadership that they themselves installed. So we have but we're wrapping up now. Kermit, I wanted to ask whether you see any hope for a turnaround for Harlem and the Harlems of the United States.
Well, I cannot say that I see a lot of hope. I really can't. I wish I could. But there's one thing I would like to say to all of our listeners. I would like if I could get an email at info@kermited.com.
That's because E-A-D-Y.
info@kermit, kermited.com. I would like to approach the president and say, we've got a plan. And I would like to present, we don't have to call it the Black United Fund, and I don't want to be the leader, but I'd like to be the consultant. And we can raise money from the African-American community, and all we're asking you to do is support it. Telling corporate America, the feds, the state, and whatnot to open up for payroll deductions. That's all we want him to do. I would like to present him with a proposal. I would like if our listeners would send me an email telling me whether they would support this or whether they would not.
Well, we do need to wrap up. We are very close on time. So go ahead, finish up your thought, Corinne.
No, I mean, because in my opinion, you know, we've got to build economically. We've got to build economically. And then if he doesn't support it, then we can deal with it. But we cannot deal with it until we approach him and says, will you support this? So I would like it if I could get an email from you. We want to do something very similar to the Black United Fund, but we'll call it something else. You can select the leader. We need some money. We will talk about that. But I would like very much if you could do that. Thank you so much,
Kermit, for being with us today. It gave us an insight into how things fall apart in communities that do have potential and still do have potential. But I want to thank you very, very much for being with us. And certainly we'll be talking with you again pretty soon. Reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. And stay tuned right here. Coming up next is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. We'll see you tomorrow. Thank you so much.
He moved away one day, so they say, away from Harlem.